Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Even I've had enough of the royals now. And I have an unlimited capacity for all of this crap.
We record this, what, on the tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock?
Is that when it is?
I believe the Harry and Meghan first episode drops with the same sort of national excitement as there will be when the Giles Crown Has No Idea episode 11, series 9 that this is, drops the day after.
I was just thinking this morning that in the olden days, and when I say olden days, I mean like the 1500s.
The 16th century.
Is that what I mean? Like 15 something or other.
Oh, for God's sake, you're an educated woman.
In like
the 16th century.
Or in like 1460, okay.
That's the 15th century.
If there was...
Oh my God.
The builders can't believe how stupid I am.
The builders have very kindly paused in the floor sounding, which was just... and where even Ben said, can they stop? And I asked them to stop and they said, yes, we have plenty other things to do.
Oh, they're Russian. I thought they were Brazilian.
I can't. That's what they sound like. We've discussed this.
Yeah, they
George, like Mourinho, I am a special one. The strange thing about Portuguese, it is right like Spanish. It is sound like Polish. That's his thing. Anyway, I am talk to Brazilian guy and thing. I'm saying, well done with football. They are very pleased. Have Brazilian builder in World Cup. Very happy. But I am say to them, please, is possible, stop sanding. And they go, yes, it's not problem. Have other things we get on with. Which was like, they didn't say, is drop large weights, repeatedly on the floor.
Yeah, drop large weights on the floor. Anyway, I was thinking, so in like 1460 or whatever, this kind of rift
between
you know, basically the House of Windsor, which is Prince Charles, William and Kate, and the Wessexes, and what?
Footnote, King Charles.
Sorry, King Charles, yes.
I know, it's like writing checks with saying 2021 well into 2022. He is King Charles.
Just between them and between the Duke and Duchess of Sussex, I can't believe they're still allowed to call themselves Duke and Duchess of Sussex. Anyway, so between Harry and Meghan, it would have just been sorted out on a muddy field somewhere. They would have gone right.
On a darkling plain where twinkling armies clash by night.
Exactly. Where's that from? That sounds good.
Yeah, I got it slightly wrong. I think
it's from The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe.
Oh, fuck off. It's like, I think it's Dover Beach by Thomas Arnold, Matthew Arnold.
Yeah.
On a darkling plain, it's not Twinkling Armies, but it's a darkling plain where something armies clash by night.
Boring. So basically, someone would have said, right, we are going to fight this out.
They'd have said,
we are
cry
meet
God
you.
For Harry, England and St. George. They'd have said, let's slip the dogs of war.
Exactly.
No.
And although not cry Harry for King, because Harry's the baddie in all of this, I think. Mm-hmm. I think. So they would have chosen a muddy field. Maybe Bosworth would be nice. And they would have just fought it out. And they would have
the House of Sussex versus the House of Windsor.
It's a bit like the Yorkians and the Lancastrians, isn't it? They were constantly...
The Yorkians?
The Yorks. They were constantly... Yorkists. They were constantly sort of... bashing each other over the head on various kind of muddy fields. And whoever was alive at the end was the winner. And I feel a bit nostalgic for those days. Not that I remember.
It really was, wasn't it? That's what happened. The Duke of York, who had been the Duke of York, but the Yorkist, Richard III, was indeed slain. My horse. I mean, a horse. Kingdom for a horse.
Right.
What's his face?
The Tudor. That's the rise of the Tudors, wasn't it?
Well, that was
Henry the Seventh.
No, that was Henry the Seventh who was
Bosworth, wasn't it?
Yes, exactly.
So Bosworth.
He was called what? His name began with a B. He was the usurper. Bolingbroke. There you go. Yeah.
Now who's thick?
Both of us. we'll come to that when we talk about MPs failing their SATs and how we wouldn't. But yes, we're both very, very stupid. Anyway. But nonetheless, despite being very, very stupid, you have had a good idea, which saying that we're bored with Harry and Meghan. And just bashing them isn't fun. The fun counterintuitive thing is to find something good to say about them, which is impossible. So you're right. It would have been like the Wars of the Roses. The clever thing to do would be a Shakespearean-style column, a play written in iambic pentameters, in which the house of, you know, these great houses twixt themselves, blah, blah, Romeo and Juliet, fight it out.
That could be quite funny. You just need to get Mistress Quickly in there. And then some kind of little...
She's like the Merry Wives of Windsor.
Mistress Quickly? No, she isn't. Falstaff's girlfriend? That would be quite fun if you could be bothered. Because then what you need is little like light relief ancillary characters called weird things like Pipe and Snagwitch. Pettifer or something.
Harry Potter. Shakespeare's you mean like Bardolph, Nim and Pissbarth?
Yeah, exactly. Bardolph.
Coxworth.
And Nim. Oh, fuck off. Fuck off, Shakespeare. You're not funny.
Funny. So do you think there's room in an 1,100-word pastiche, which bear in mind with the kind of hyphenating and justifying of the H and J-ing of a column in the op-ed, we'll probably get it down to about 800 words of the paragraphs. Do you think there's room for a subplot?
Well, Bardolph, Pistol and Nim or whatever.
Yeah,
I don't
exactly.
know. They can just pop up. They can just sort of pop, you know, enter, you know, stupid name, stupid, with Mistress Quickly. You go, oh, my liege, there's not enough beer. And then Falstaff, like, hiding behind the door with a flute, pretending to maybe bop someone on the head.
It looks like that your mission in this would be just to mock Shakespeare.
Well, I just find it quite annoying. I found all of that quite annoying. I mean, I found sort of things interesting. I managed to fancy Harry Hotspur in Henry IV, Part 1. So I was able to kind of summon up some kind of teenage enthusiasm.
Now, this is this Hotspur who kills me 10,000 Scot of a morning and cries, fie on the quiet life, I want work!
Exactly. Oh, he's hot. Harry Hotspur is super hot. Anyway.
You know, Harry Hotspur, interestingly, by the time of the action of Henry IV, Part 1, once you're asking, was 73.
And he's got his girlfriend, Kate.
Shakespeare just needed someone for Hal to tussle against. Mm. So Prince Hal, later to be Henry V, and eventually Kenneth Branagh. he's like pissed off by his sort of dorky crusading Christian dad. Hangs out with Falstaff in the Boar's Head at Eastcheap and sort of does the shagging and stuff. And then he needs to have some journey. You with your Save the Cat rules for
fiction writing.
Yeah, but I mean Shakespeare managed somehow without having a guidebook to how to write stories to say that
he was a rare genius. And when everyone else was writing boring things like the Duchess of Malfi, and he was writing actual things with actual, where you know, he turns Harry Hotspur into this kind of uptight, humorless, dorky.
But what he mostly does is he brings him back from, I think, the grave, if not sort of old age from the future, to brings him back to give Hal a nemesis that he can sort of sharpen himself against and overcome in order to progress to Henry IV Part 2 and the real money.
Exactly. Well, look, it sounds like you're enthusiastic about this.
Well, I do, but it's just hard work.
It is hard work. But, you know, sometimes you wake up on a Thursday and you quite fancy doing a job of work rather than just turning out the same old shit.
It all depends whether I've got a lunch. So the last 3 weeks I've done the same old shit. The last 3 weeks I've written the same old column,
because
Phil Move.
Because it's Advent.
But the readers have started noticing. I want to give Rishi Sunak a wedgie. Rishi Sunak's a wanker, I wrote. Slightly more sophisticated, but not much. Then I wrote, kill all the architects.
They thought that was fun.
Fucking mental. Yeah. Last week, kill all the cold swimmers, wild swimmers.
But everyone loves that.
A lot of Rishi Sunak voters who were architects who like cold swimming. Yeah. They didn't like my column. Anyway, by the third one, people going, huge fan, Giles, love it. This column's really great. You're on a roll. Possibly next week, that's enough of the monofaceted ranting against a small interest group nobody cares about.
And it was all because Tom Baldwin said that he liked it when
he did.
But Tom Baldwin is like...
Tom Baldwin, just for the reader, was the political editor of The Times and was a great pal of mine when I worked in the office 25 years ago.
But he was also... I mean, he also... Tom Baldwin was...
A wild man. He was a wild man of journalism.
He was sort of a wild man of journalism. Stories about Tom Baldwin were quite...
You can't tell any of them.
I'm not going to tell any of them. Don't suggest that there are stories. No, but there are, and everyone knows.
But he was basically the Alistair Campbell to Ed Miliband. Which is like...
Which is much less impressive than all the stuff that he... No, but he was amazing. He was a proper reporter. He was very, very good. He was in with...
He's still great. He's not in decline.
No, he's brilliant. I love Tom Baldwin. And he was still at the paper when I was very little. And he was really nice to all the little young reporters. Now, I haven't got a bad word to say about Tom Baldwin at all.
He's just a bit crackers. He's absolutely fucking mental.
Yeah. Well,
in the 90s, when I was in the lobby, or when I was doing the parliamentary sketch. No, 2000, something like that. He was there, just knew his way around a bottle of wine, just with piles up on his desk. And we'd go out for meals, so sort of a tapas. It'd be 9 p.m. and a call would come through, you know, need 400 words on that. And Tom would just, you know, have his phone clipped into his shoulder and he would be writing notes on the tablecloth. Get me Gordon Brown. And Gordon Brown would be on the line. He'd go, oh, what's this about that? And then he'd dictate it into the phone. It would go in the paper. Fucking amazing. Anyway, so I went out for a meal up the road with him and Roland, my editor. Who's the guy who I ultimately have to file this column to? And I'd written,
he doesn't know how.
I think I said this last week. What? But I'd written, and maybe I didn't. And I'd written a slightly iffy column, which is one of my. On the one hand, I never really do. On the one hand, on the other, but I'd written a slightly soppy column, and he'd gone, oh, much better when you really take something with like a terrier between your teeth and just go for it. So I've overdone it. So now you're saying I should come back and do a Shakespeare pastiche?
Why not?
I haven't got lunch tomorrow. I have got time.
You do know where you are. I mean, look, even like a basic... I mean, you only have to have read know a Shakespeare play a little bit in order to do it. It's quite easy.
The truth is, you go to Bartleby or one of those texts, you get a text from Henry IV, you copy it, you move it into a Word file, and you go through changing the words, and you put in things like Sunak, Harry, bum...
Yeah,
and it all comes together, and people think that you're a genius.
So the story would be, so you would be, but it's just condensing the story.
Oh, it's just speeches. You'd have to do the speech on the eve of Agincourt.
Yeah, or something like that. Yeah, exactly.
Men abed, which will call themselves accursed that we're not here.
Because
they didn't get up in time to watch it at 8 a.m.
Exactly.
On Netflix. And then we shall wall it up with our English dead. There'll be more from Esther and me in our kitchen after a short interlude. But to find out what I wrote about in the end, why not pick up a subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times and enjoy 1 month absolutely free? Just search thetimes.co.uk/Giles Corran has no idea. I've been promised that this will take you to an amazing offer, rather than just a website created by Ben randomly containing all my broadcasting mistakes. Although I'm sure that exists somewhere, it's just going to be up to you to find it.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal, to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
My thing is how completely obsessed the media is. Is the media singular? How obsessed the media are with...
Very important pronouns. You mustn't upset them.
With publishing sensations, okay? So the media just... People generally are fed quite a lot of stories about how the secret to your new life is writing a novel and that will change your life and you'll be a billionaire like J.K. Rowling or very professionally fulfilled and you will be able to quit your job. And that is, and I go, this is false advertising.
Is that, darling, all crap?
And you
have a head of steam and carry on, but is the media really... Sorry. Are the media really focused on that? Or is that what you see because you are in a phase of your career where you feel like you'd rather be a novelist and you're focusing on that and you think it's being sold to you?
No, I absolutely don't think that at all. I read the papers carefully and faithfully, and I have done since I was 15 years
old. And you
think
they fetishise novel
yes,
writing?
Yes, they fetishise novel writing completely. You do not ever see stories in the paper about someone who said, I wanted to write a novel and I tried and tried and tried and tried and I tried for 10 years and no one bought it and so I gave up. You do not see those stories, and those are basically...
And yet what stories. They do, I see, you're quite right, and J.K. Rowling, all anyone knows is it was rejected 37 times.
Yeah.
Or any of these people.
It's the publisher's nightmare. They're like, stop telling that story. Yeah.
Ian Rankin is the same. It's people go, it's only, you know, you and they get rejected for the 33rd time, your misspelt story about your boring life. And you and your husband goes, don't worry, darling, J.K. Rowling was sent back 37 times. And so they fucking keep on plugging
Actually, J.K. Rowling's stories, she was only rejected by 14 publishers. That's not very many. And she wasn't rejected by any agents. So in terms of the writing, in terms of writing rejection, she basically wasn't rejected
She's
at
basically
all.
Basically an overnight success.
Basically a whole in one overnight success. And I think people have a completely wrong idea of how fucking shit it is to be a writer of any sort.
Until
this brilliant story by this very lovely, just gorgeous looking girl. She's written a brilliant book. A brilliant, very timely, and I can see because I've got a bit of an eye on.
Why is she
fiction market at the moment?
Got dyed like red Heidi. Hair and pig.
I think
pig
she looks cute,
and a pirate top.
I think she looks very cute, and also she's a genre fiction writer, and that's her genre.
But the genre is buxom wench rough sex.
Yeah. What?
sorry, that's my last Google search. Sorry about that.
Just fucking hell! Just get a grip on yourself. Okay, so she's called Chelsea Banning.
Go on, quickly tell the story now before people get bored.
Just give me... before you get bored.
Okay.
People don't get that bored, okay? You don't have to talk as fast as you do because nobody gets as bored as fast as you do, okay? I'm just trying to find out what the name of the book is that she wrote, okay?
It's not important.
She's got... stop it now. She has written... So Chelsea Banning is this author. She has written a book called Of Crowns and Legends, which is about the twins...
The plot doesn't matter!
She's written a book called Of Crowns and Legends, which is the first book in a trilogy, okay? And I think I believe it's historical fiction. And she tweeted on December the 4th, only two people came to my author signing yesterday, so I was pretty bummed about it. Especially as 37 people responded they were going to the event. Kind of upset, honestly, and a little embarrassed.
So you were just saying how you never hear a story about failed authors who didn't then succeed.
Yeah.
The story here is that two people went to a book signing. So that's made it in the paper.
So that's made it. Yes, exactly. But this is quite.
You but don't, why
this
is it made
very
in the paper?
Rare. So it's made in the paper because lots of very, very famous authors replied to her tweet with their own stories of being neglected and rejected.
J.K. Rowling?
Not J.K. Rowling.
She missed an opportunity to get in the paper.
Jonathan Coe, the writer of Water Carver and The Rotters Club, among many other famous authors, told Banning that he had once been invited to a crime writers' festival where Colin Dexter, the creator of the Inspector Morse novels, was on at the same time. Only one person showed up for me, says Coe. We chatted for a while, and I told him how glad I was that he'd come. He said, actually, I'm Ian Rankin, and I was supposed to be introducing you. Ian Rankin, nicest man in the world, by the way.
Although, you haven't asked me, but I have done a book signing next table to Ian Rankin.
And how did that go?
Well, so this story is about... So Neil Gaiman has said...
And
all
Margaret
these people have told these stories about book signings when they didn't do well. Now, there is an element of humble brag there. There is your narrative, you only hear about J.K. Rowling because she succeeded. For Margaret Atwood, for Neil Gaiman, for Jonathan Coe, for any of these people, it's all, ha ha ha, I was once not incredibly famous and in demand. They're telling the story from the perspective that you can't believe that they were ever not successful.
Right.
So they are really fostering this thing of saying you should keep at it even when you're failing.
Well, but the other thing is, that is also actually true.
Yes.
Is that you need to keep at it even if you're failing as a writer because it's a fucking numbers game.
Well,
and it's also a zeitgeist game. But most of you will spend most of your time as a writer with people going, no. And even if you get your book deal, and even if you've got your agent, and even if all of that, and you've written your book, and you've got a trilogy, and it's really, I mean, she's clearly written this book that is really like now, and everyone wants it, and I think it's probably going to be a huge...
Oh, really?
It's a really good book.
Even then,
you go to a fucking book signing, and two people show up. Now, there is so much to say about this, but obviously, this is a bit of a bugbear of mine, but I don't want to rattle on about my old shit.
You're thinking, because you're at the stage where you're still trying to get a book published,
I bet you're deep down thinking you're quite jealous of her just for having the books out. You're thinking I should Coco. That's the least of my worries.
Well, I'm looking at her and going, yeah, that's a fucking good idea. I'm not surprised.
Steal the book. If no one's going to her book, man, take it. Ruin her fucking life. First, you know, not only does that, but Esther Walker then copied my story.
Yeah, exactly.
Of course, yes, it plays into all sorts of things, doesn't it? It's.
But what is it? But the
humiliation of the book tour.
Oh, God. And it's just so annoying how authors who are the shyest, yeah, weirdest people in the world are expected to then go and fucking show their knickers to the public, either on Twitter, where they just get piled on and called, you know, racist and transphobic for, yeah, their completely like random book that they've written. And then publishers expect authors to be their own publicity machines. They are the least suited people to it.
Why is this, picking up the story from you still trying to get a book published to me having had 3 or 4 books published,
yeah,
and like got published because I already had a name and because I wrote for the Times, because my father was a writer, who knows what reason, wrote some perfectly decent books, but I failed at a later stage than you. But the reason they expect you to do that is because publishers are all idiots. I mean, we should have built up towards that point, but I want to get it out there now.
You can say that. I think publishers are fantastic.
Yes, of course you do. Well, I think they can all go fuck themselves. They've all tried, especially Jonathan Cape, Viking, Orion Business, HarperCollins, owned by Rupert Murdoch, one of the publishing... They're nice, they're great, they're one of the top...
Decent
they're
people.
Really awesome, proper people they are. But they'd never send you on a book tour. So the thing is that what they do is they first of all, they publishers, the way that, you know, Bloomsbury is really only Harry Potter. But Bloomsbury was doing fuck all, Harry Potter came along, rah. What they do is they put their whole budget into one book. So you sell... Specky Guy off Pointless and his Dead Grannies series. Mm-hmm. You put all your... you sell 5 million copies of that, as you have. Who gives a shit whether they buy your little literary novelist? In theory, that money should trickle down, like, yeah, Reaganomics, and that should fund them to spend money on publicising this poor woman. But no, yeah, whoever publishes her is putting their entire publishing budget into getting it. They want a Sally Rooney, or they want a Richard Osman, or they want one of the J.K. Rowling, a Graham Norton, one of those... And she, they say, go out on a book tour.
Let's find out who is her publisher.
And what she's doing, it's like, I get invited to literary festivals, so I go, what's the fee? Nothing, you might sell some books. Fuck off.
You don't expect people to sell any books.
No, the point is, the flip side is, what if 32 people had come to her book signing, yeah?
Yeah.
10 of them would have bought books. That would have got her 75p off each book. She'd have made £7.50. There was no fucking point going at all. Yeah. It's just a bogus, exploitative...
It is very, very...
And I'll tell you about the time when I went to a book signing, right?
I just want to find out who her publisher...
Don't name them. It's more fun, because then we can say meaner things. Book signing. I've had that humiliation. Hey on Why. Went to sign book signing for my novel, quite exciting. Went into the tent, they said it's this way, or it's the desk over there. Massive queue, just walking down the queue, nodding at these people. No one's
been with you in a minute.
People didn't really recognise me in those days, so nobody really waved back and everything. Got through sort of about 200 people and got to the front of the queue, and there was Ian Rankin sitting at the table. And I was at the table next to him. Hello, Giles, he said.
Oh.
I said, hello, Ian. I said, no, whoops, sorry, mate. It's very difficult talking to Scots people not to do their voice.
Yeah.
And no, he knew of me and whatever. And I sat down and I had nobody. And I just sat there watching Ian
just fetching him water
book after book after book,
opening the books for him.
Yeah, and until eventually Ian just sort of, one of the people said, "Why didn't you have a look at Giles's book?" And eventually, from Ian's thing, he managed to persuade about 3 or 4 of his signees to come over and get books signed by me.
They turned back to him and said, "Will you sign my book after
I had to sign Ian Rankin's book. Anyway, it wasn't not copies of mine. It's really, really humiliating and awful sitting there. It's like, I mean, as we all know, the horror of throwing a party and you don't know who's going to come and is anyone going to show up, and sometimes they don't. And it's like that.
Are you going to be able to talk about Ben Stokes without crying?
Oh, I don't know. I'm thinking about Christmas TV now, because I was talking
to
Ben about it.
Okay, let's talk about Christmas
TV. Can we do Ben Stokes after the Christmas
TV? Yeah, what else have you got to say about Christmas TV? How's that interesting?
Well, it's just that that's exactly what Ben said, so maybe I should sort
of... It's not interesting, but convince me.
No, it's just that there's always this time of year you get... I mean, the stories about them being nothing on the telly at Christmas seem to come earlier and earlier. But everybody, Daily Mail readers love more than anything, there's nothing good on the telly anymore. But they love stories about Christmas, isn't what it was. So if you have Christmas telly isn't as good as it used to be, then that's a great thing. And it's just, so there's lots and lots of repeats. The schedule is actually exactly the same as last year. Strictly Come Dancing, Michael McIntyre's The Wheel, Call the Midwife, EastEnders and Mrs. Brown's Boys. With the only change being a special of the sitcom Ghosts, which I've never heard of.
You know the Now Show?
The Now Show?
It's basically like Punt and Dennis have written a sitcom about
ghosts.
Don't
name them particularly, but that's not fair because they're both nice men. But they're nice men, but I
didn't say anything pejorative about it. What I said
the
is like...
The Now Show!
But it's like...
It's the bit when I've literally smashed so many really good Robert's radios when you're just like, just cooking up... Is it Saturday evenings or Friday? You're having a meal and you're cooking some food and you're roasting a chicken and you listen to the news and then it goes, bong, The Now Show! Smash! Smash! Dead child, chicken down the toilet, fucking emigrating. Anyway, sorry.
I didn't say...
But now! I'm going to do that all the way through.
Okay.
Is that enough, Ben? No,
Ben
I'm kidding.
Stokes.
Ben Stokes. Okay.
Where do we start?
So, where do we start with Ben Stokes? If I write anything relating to cricket or shooting off cricket, which is what I plan to do, about why Ben Stokes needs to be running the universe, not just a cricket team. It's not very clickbaity.
But don't worry about that, because that just requires a clickbaity headline that you can maybe suggest. So I don't know what
terrorist Stokes in trans row.
Britney Spears. Yeah, exactly. exactly.
Pronoun Storm adds Benjamina Stokes identifies as pansexual
or something. So you just need a clickbaity headline like that, and then you have to not lose people in the first 100 words. Okay.
Basically, Ben Stokes took this team of cricketers who are all talented, but they're not better than cricketers have been, particularly over the years, and pulled off a repeated sort of cluster triumph of captaining decisions. And the main thing he did was he facilitated the success of his players by enabling them to fail. Ben Stokes went in there saying, we're not going to draw. Drawing is not an option. And bearing in mind that one of the reasons that people have been losing interest in Test cricket over the years is because it often ends in a draw. And it's really boring. And non-fans, particularly Americans and people, can't understand how you play a game for five
minutes. We don't want the Americans to understand.
That's true. We don't want to keep it from them. But the game will go on and on for 5 days and will often end in a draw, and particularly in Pakistan. And this looked like it could have been a draw from day two. Because it was very easy to bat. So Ben Stokes, which he was doing all last summer, had his team go out there and score very, very quickly to get enough runs to put Pakistan in, to give them a chance of winning, which was the only way that England could win. Because if Pakistan knew they couldn't win, they could bat out on this very soft wicket for a draw. So he made them believe by declaring at tea time, but halfway through tea time, because he only had to give them 10 minutes warning, he waited for the Pakistan team to sit down and start eating their sandwiches and drinking their orange squash, and then waited for the clock to tick round. And with 10 minutes to go, he said, we declare, you're batting. And they all had to leap up and like half finish their sandwich, slope down the queue, or run off, like put on their kit, get out there. But the main thing was, he said, it doesn't matter if we lose. What we're trying to do is win. Okay. And it's I suddenly realised, looking at my children and thinking back to my childhood, about how I was crippled by the fear of failure and how Britain has always been crippled by the fear of failure. And it's there in our politics. It's there in our economics. It's there in, you know, Britain is not an experimental culture. We don't produce defining art. Like, we never have, particularly. You know, things like modernism and cubism and all that stuff, all that sort of risky horse shit that turned out to be quite good, Britain would never have done. Because,
and when T.S. Eliot did something really experimental with The Wasteland and took it to Buckingham Palace and read it to the royal family, they all laughed.
Yeah.
Because they were like, what is this horse shit?
Yeah, and T.S. Eliot was American.
Partly, oh.
So, well, no, that's a good point. But it's only because, you know, he was, it was the closest thing, the modern, or Joyce, who was Irish. But the English,
right.
The English didn't do anything.
No,
the English
don't.
Just kept plodding along saying, and then he had a cup of tea.
Mm. We're basically administrators,
aren't
we?
Ben Stokes would have come in there and said, no, this is shit poetry. Mm-hmm. I'm going to take away the capital letters. We're going to write everything in green ink. And we're going to do some of it in French.
He does look like a green inker.
Yeah, he does.
But sometimes you do need that. Okay, fine. So I think, but the content of this piece is not going to be an issue, okay? Because you could write why don't you write... Sorry, stupid question.
I'm going to say, my problem here is I haven't explained it at all. Because the one thing... I love Ben Stokes so much.
I know.
And I feel the story so deeply... I want him to notice me.
He will one day.
That I find it very hard to write about. So the thing is, here's the thing with Ben Stokes. Everyone is surprised he's turned out to be a great captain. Okay, everyone, who would have thought he'd be the greatest captain ever? He's better than Vaughan. He's better than Strauss. He's better than Brearley. And yet he's a tattooed, beery, pub fighting northern hooligan. So how come that he's been able to do this? The snobbery of English cricket has always been gentlemen and players. The guy who goes to Cambridge, Atherton, Hussain, they're the ones who are meant to be the great captains, and grunts like Stokes just run in, bowl fast, smash the ball. And then when he was picked as captain, and all the papers said this is a bad decision, this will be like when Flintoff was captain, or Peterson was captain, or Botham was captain, when a big man with all that talent is so self-involved that he can't lead and he can't provide vision. Stokes, there was on the eve of the first Stokes' first test as captain, there was a documentary called Summer of Stokes, which is about his great performing summer of 2019, when he won a test match at Headingley. Was the last man, there was 79 to get, I think, just him and Jack Leach, little specky guy, left arm spinner, couldn't bat at all, and they had to bat and bat and bat to make these runs, and no one thought they could do it, and Stokes did it, and Leach got one run while supporting Stokes, getting us over the line. And in this interview, Stokes said, we went out there to bat and there was 79 to get and there was Leachy at the other end, and the task really didn't look possible, but I knew that if one of us was going to get out, I wanted it to be me. I didn't want Leachy to have to fail in front of such a big crowd with such a big task. And the idea that famously, English batsmen never gave a shit about the bloke at the other end. People like Jeff Boycott, they guard their statistics, they guard their averages.
Don't care about all the bloke at the end, it's all about my runs. You always
make Jeff Boycott sound like an Israeli. You've got to stop that. There's no R. He didn't talk like that. And then he goes for a falafel. It's not for Jeff Boycott.
That is how he sounds.
It's not how he sounds. But anyway.
My batting average.
The point is that this is a man who defends gay people outside pubs from homophobic attack and would rather fail himself to save his buddy from the public opprobrium. And we need people like that leading our schools, leading our health service, leading our unions, leading our governments. We need people who are not looking for a draw, who will go all out to win. Okay. And protect their friends from failure.
So this reminds me of sometimes in a restaurant, if someone's ordered a disgusting starter, you always eat it for them.
That's as close as I get to being like
that. That is basically as close. But it is the same principle. You know, if I've ordered something that's sort of yucky, but I quite fancied it, and then it's actually... And you just look at me and you just go, is that horrid? Just, I'll eat it. It's fine. You have mine. Actually, I haven't done that for years. But I don't order stupid things anymore. Anyway, look, moving on. If you want people to read this column and not be put off by the fact that it's about cricket, you have to... The headline in the first bit has to be, you know, if you want to be a winner, be like Stokes. Or if you want to win, you can't be afraid to fail or something. People will be drawn in by the idea that they can learn something that is useful to them by these parallels that happen in sports.
It's a thing that England's coach was saying, the new England cricket coach, was saying, oh, fuck's his name, Baz.
You've got a total block Brendan on his
McCullum.
Name.
Brendan McCullum. Fuck.
Baz?
Can you make it like not? No, because it's Baz Ball and they call him Baz. Right. Can we like make it where I know what his name is? I'm going to leave Haley. You've been listening to Giles Corran Has No Idea with me, Giles Corran,
and me, Esther Walker.
It's a Wireless Studios production for The Times, produced by Ben Mitchell. You can listen to us on the Times Radio app or download from wherever you get your podcasts.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Off Air, the podcast. With Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
Keep your cheese in the sink.
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times Radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
How would that go in the booth?
Badly. Go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times Radio app.